This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hscc.org.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for inviting me to speak here today. Very beautiful place, and just was very powerful request you made before. Not quite sure if I can live up to it, but I try. And I just want to introduce myself shortly. My name is Ayasanta Chita, and I'm originally from Austria, so I speak with an accent I hope you can understand. And I've been trained in the Theravada forest tradition for about over 20 years, and some years in Thailand. And I have also a teacher in the Tibetan tradition in the Nyingma school. And I'm living now since almost 4 years here in San Francisco together with two other nuns, and we have started a small monastery in Sunset District. And I've brought some material about our place, which is upstairs on the table. You could help yourself to it if you like it afterwards, and also bought a few books for free distribution if you're interested. And it's kind of interesting, you know, to have only men sitting out there, besides Naomi, who came with me, so I've never done that, but because we have more women coming to our place, of course, because we want to set up a training monastery for nuns. So I don't feel intimidated, but I notice the difference somehow. So, yeah. I brought a little quote from Suzuki Roshi, who is the founding teacher of your lineage, I've heard. And I thought that then it can be help me to get started. And he says, "Everything is already perfect, but there's a lot of room for improvement." And I always found that a very good reflection, because, you know, at least that's how we call it in the Theravada school where I'm trained in, and I've also heard in the Tibetan school, speaking about the middle way, the middle path between the two extremes. And on one hand, you know, ultimately everything is already perfect as it is, but then conventionally we tend to not be able to connect with that perfection quite frequently, you know, when we are thrown about by the afflictive emotions and when we have, you know, strong energies moving through our body and our mind, it's sometimes quite difficult to connect with the innate perfection of everything just as it is. And, you know, that's because of the power of that throwing around. I have chosen, you know, to live this life because I felt I really need a strong support to be able to hold steady in the midst of the challenges, you know, when greed, hatred, and delusion are triggered by, you know, different experiences and people, relationships we meet in the world. And all of this can be included into practice, but to remember it when we are triggered, that's another thing. And you know, the whole life we can call an opportunity for practice, but we tend to forget it, especially, you know, when when it would be actually a very good thing to remember it, we tend to not remember. And I'm feeling, you know, in this day and age which we are living in today, there is a lot of uncertainty. I mean, there always is uncertainty, but it's never so much into your face as it is nowadays with the whole issue of climate change. And I feel that this time right now, where we could, you know, come to the tipping point of what this planet can cope with any moment. We don't know when it's going to happen, but it is just something which is on the cards, and it can, you know, it can hit us any moment. So I think, you know, to have a strong practice has never been more important as it is right now, because there's really nowhere to go anymore now. We can only wake up. That's the only place to go. It's just, you know, within rather than without, because without there is not much space left, and a lot has been so much impacted, you know, by our greed, hatred and delusion, that, you know, it's looking pretty sad. But even, you know, even that huge perspective of we maybe, you know, wiping ourselves off the planet, even that, you know, can be an opportunity for practice if we are having, you know, enough wisdom and compassion to open up to it and to not see it as something which is outside of the practice. But I think it's such a big issue that I think there's lots of people still, you know, who don't even want to hear about it, and a lot of denial and a lot of wrong information is coming down to us through the media. And to really sort that out, we really have to take an interest in what's happening. And in terms of, you know, of of elements, you know, which are together producing certain, you know, mind states for us, it's not very different from other things. It's just the hugeness of it is just unprecedented. And, you know, and together as a group like here today, you know, to sit in that truth, it can be very powerful and very empowering. Because, you know, we are not alone in this, we are all together in this. And, you know, once we really take that to heart, I feel, you know, a new window of opportunity opens up, because, you know, that togetherness, this third refuge of Sangha is a very powerful agent for transformation and a very powerful support. And, you know, people like you are here in this group who have a regular practice. We're very fortunate, really, in this time now, because you have something to fall back onto, and you have something to make sense out of the whole situation. Because it's you know, this environmental crisis is something which we have been co-creating with nature. Because we have been, you know, not really understanding how nature works. So we have been, you know, doing things for quite a long time which have been producing an effect we really haven't intended. And now we seem to wake up to it as a society more and more. And people who tend to have a spiritual practice are quicker, you know, in picking things up, because there is a more capacity for sensitivity there generally, because you know you have been meditating for some time, and you know having a certain understanding about how the mind works, and generally less afraid of feeling. And that's a very good beginning, you know, because we can connect to life only through feeling. And if we cut ourselves off from feeling, we cut ourselves off from life. And that's one of the main issues, I think, you know, which has brought us to this environmental crisis. A culture which is quite cynical about feeling, you know, and cynical about the feminine aspect, which is, you know, present in all genders, but the feminine aspect which is open to feeling and which is open to hold chaos and creativity, which has been, you know, put into the second place now for hundreds of years because of the way how evolution is going. There's nobody to blame. It's just like how it is. You know, we are waking up to a time where we need that capacity very much, you know, to be able to open to chaos and admit, you know, defeat, so to say. We can't control nature because we are part of nature. But we can get to know her and we can make, you know, we can make friends. And a practice like this technology, we can say, you know, how we can make friends with her, with the laws of nature, by just sitting down in this way, how you're doing it, and listening, you know, listening what she has to say, what she has to tell us about how our minds work, how our bodies work, and through that, you know, we gain increasing clarity, not by, you know, kind of storing up more information or more knowledge, but actually by tearing away veils of delusion, you know, kind of certain assumptions we have about the way things work, which have turned out to be utterly misguided in some ways, you know. Because we have been polluting so much. That wasn't our intention. We just wanted to, as a human species, we wanted to originally, you know, have more things so that everybody can have their share. But what turns out is that we end up with a very polluted planet, and you know the resources are just like for a very small group of people. There is all kind of concentrated there, and there's so many people who don't have nothing or have very little. So it has not worked out, you know, our way of going about things, because we are quite ignorant, you know, not paying attention to the way things really work. And now we have this huge wake-up call, because we have come, you know, almost to the limit of what can be done. Now we have to change our ways, because we are forced to. And that's probably a good thing, because otherwise we wouldn't. So just bearing this in mind as an incentive, you know, for practice can be very sobering, I think. And also, you know, trusting that there's more there in the depths of our connection to life, there's guidance there. We just need to have, you know, the ears, or the hearts rather, to listen to this guidance. And, you know, and someone, you know, who is really connected to the guidance of life is someone I would call a wise being. And they might have studied a lot, but they might not have, actually. Because it's not like accumulated knowledge from the books, you know, like difficult suttas or difficult, instructions which we can remember. But it's more like, wisdom is not a body of knowledge, but wisdom is a capacity, you know, to be with the way things are without, you know, putting concepts on top of it, and then allowing oneself to be informed by that process which we call nature. without putting any veils in between it. And the word prajna is a Sanskrit word and has a nya means knowledge, and pra means is a verb, gives it a very dynamic nuance, and pra means actually before. So the word wisdom means actually before knowledge. So this is, you know, if we look at something and before we start thinking about it, that moment before the mind starts thinking, that's when there's wisdom. Because then we are directly with the way things are without kind of putting some past story on top of it. And that's the moment, you know, when we really are in contact, in relationship with something in its suchness. And this is, you know, how we can increase wisdom. If we have more moments of that being with in suchness, this is when wisdom is growing, and this is when wisdom is, you know, kind of becoming more permeating our being. And that's then something, you know, which is not something we have stored up in the somewhere in the brain or so, but it becomes part of our being, and it is with us wherever we go. So then something hits us, you know, some trigger comes. We don't have to think about, oh, the Buddha said everything is impermanent, but we are knowing it. We are knowing it. And then, you know, we don't have so much surface for the trigger to hit us. Because this wisdom, you know, has an effect on us. We become very fluent, or, you know, we can flow. We are not rigid any longer. We can just be with the way things are. That doesn't mean, you know, we become like a victim of the situation, but we are part of it, because we are realizing more and more that we are part of nature. We are not separate from her. We are part of this whole process of life, and we don't have to, you know, fall for extremes. As I said before, you know, the middle way between everything is perfect and everything is terrible, and everything is just out, you know, to get me, basically. Those two extremes, we just tend to, you know, fluctuate between those two. And, you know, some people who are called bipolar, they are, you know, they have gone so far that they, you know, they can't function anymore, because the pendulum swings so extreme that we consider them to be, you know, ill. And we all have that illness to a certain extent, but we manage, you know, to kind of pull it off, you know. And this kind of a practice which we are doing is bringing, you know, this pendulum to ever lesser swings, because we are through having insight in the way things work, you know, we have less and less rigidity, so there's less and less surface, you know, to be swung. And, you know, equilibrium, equanimity is one of the four Brahmaviharas, the four divine abidings, you know, which is a result of wisdom, and at the same time also it's a ground in which wisdom can grow. And I personally, when I started my practice, when I heard the first time about the middle way, that really caught my attention very much. And I felt very, very attracted to the teaching, because that's something I'd never considered before. Because I always, you know, like most younger people, we feel attracted to extremes, you know. And we think, you know, if we're standing out in some way extreme, that is a good thing. And then, you know, over the years, if we keep going that way, we tend to get exhausted at one point. And then we feel like, oh, maybe it would be interesting, you know, to have a life which is a little bit less challenging. And at that point, this is when I heard, you know, when I was ripe to hear a teaching and really consider it. And And when I heard this about the middleweights, it sounded so healing to me, that there's a possibility here, you know, to have somewhere to observe everything from. And then, you know, one of the founder of the lineage I've been trained in the forest tradition, he was a Thai master, his name is Ajahn Chah, he's passed away in the 90s, and you know, he would, if people would ask him questions, he would say something to one person and then something completely different to another person. And then people were kind of saying, what kind of a teacher is this, you know? He says this to you and this to me, it doesn't make any sense to me. And he would say, you know, if somebody goes too far to the right, he would say, go to the left. And if somebody goes too far to the left, he'd say, go to the right. And in terms of, you know, if people veer too much off on one side of the extremes, just telling them, come into the middle. This is, you know, the ground from which we can observe how life works. And through this observation, we can grow in wisdom and compassion. And it's not like a going up, up, up. But it's like a going down, down, down into the depths of the process of life. And allowing the process, you know, to reveal itself to us. And the only, you know, foremost quality we need to develop for that is the willingness to be with feeling, really. Which is not an easy thing to do. And, you know, living this kind of very privileged lives, which we live in a Western society with lots of props, you know, we are especially susceptible to have little tolerance for unpleasant feeling, because we just press a button here and, you know, press a button there and make it hotter and colder and this and that. We are very low tolerance, you know. So if we know in these times of impending big changes, we need to kind of amp up our tolerance for lots of things we haven't been really thinking about a lot, because we always like. Yeah, we have all been schooled, I think, you know, in a culture which thinks there's endless growth, there's endless kind of making it all better, making it all more. But we have really come to a point now that it's obvious it's not going to go that way. So this is where we can, you know, consider ourselves very fortunate to have a practice and have a teaching which has all of the information we need to strengthen our capacity to, you know, to be with the way things are and learning from it. And then, you know, that equilibrium, this equanimity which is the result of it, the wisdom and the compassion, and then, you know, bring it into our lives and share it with others. So it's a great privilege to be able to do that. A precious human life, and that coinciding with meeting a teaching like this is considered very fortunate. So we cannot take solace from that. Whatever is going to happen next, we at least, you know, we have a framework within which we can hold all of that. And I've recently read a very beautiful analogy about our situation, and it's called the butterfly story. I'd like to share with you. And you know, at the beginning, a butterfly is a caterpillar, and then at one point in the existence, that caterpillar starts to overeat, and it eats like about 300 times its body weight in a day. So it starts to horrendously over-consume. There's some kind of comparison there with our culture also. You know, and then the butterfly, that caterpillar over-consumes until it can't move anymore. It becomes very sluggish and very, very heavy. And then it hangs itself from a tree or somewhere, and then the skin starts to kind of harden, and it becomes what's called a chrysalis. And then the body of the caterpillar is inside the chrysalis and starts to dissolve into a soup. And then it was, for a long time, it wasn't clear, you know, how one creature, how a caterpillar can change into a butterfly. But then scientists found out that actually, during the lifetime of the caterpillar, there are some so-called imaginary cells in the system of the caterpillar already built in. And then in the time of crisis, those imaginary cells start to wake up. And then they are through the soup of the dissolved caterpillar, those imaginary cells multiply. And then at one point, you know, there's the tipping point, and then the imaginary cells are taking over, and then a completely new creature, a butterfly, is constellated, and then at one point, you know, slips out of the chrysalis and flies off. And, you know, that's a kind of a good analogy about if one worldview is kind of breaking down. There's always some people who are those imaginary cells, you know, and they coexist together with the old system for some time, and then at one point, you know, the tipping point sets in, and then they start to multiply very quickly and link up with each other, and then the new worldview, the butterfly, is born. And I've recently heard, you know, for a tipping point to come, it needs only 7% of the population for the tipping point, you know, and then there's no more return. So I find it very encouraging. You know, it's not so many people, actually. And we could all be, you know, we could all be those imaginary cells. And with the practice we have, you know, we have all of the tools to really, you know, strengthen ourselves so that we can hold that friction, you know, which a change of worldview inevitably, you know, brings to us. And also, you know, the capacity to really look at what's happening, because if you don't really fully look at it, the change won't be born. It comes from really seeing what's going on, and then, you know, the change is not something we have to force ourselves, but we just have to take in what's happening, and then the change is actually something which is born out of seeing clearly. But in order to see clearly, we have to look, you know, and long enough. And we don't have to kind of force ourselves, but to just see, you know, looking at some information, and how quickly, you know, we just have to do something else. And just, you know, even doing it if it needs to be done, but just noticing it, you know. And that's all part of the process, to just really notice how we busy ourselves with things which are maybe not so important, you know. See if there's a certain element of, you know, wanting to distract ourselves, because we have, you know, we don't know what to do, and we think because we don't know what to do, we shouldn't look. But it's not the way how the Buddha has been realizing enlightenment, you know. He didn't know what to do either. But he just made a resolve. He's not going to move. And I know you are, you know, probably not. I mean, I think I at least, let's see, myself. I don't think I'm gonna necessarily, you know, realize complete enlightenment this lifetime. But it doesn't really matter. It could be. There's a very small possibility that I might. So that keeps me going, you know. And there's this another very beautiful analogy. And when the Buddha was sitting under the Bodhi tree in the night of his enlightenment, there were all of those different, you know, personifications of Mara coming to him and, you know, hurling weapons against him and sending him beautiful women and all of that. And he just decided to just sit there and not move. And then all of those assaults, those weapons, they turned into flowers. They turned into blessings because they were the soil for wisdom and compassion to grow out of, you know. If there's no experiences, there's no process, there's no learning. So we need those. They are the soil for those flowers, you know, to grow. And whatever, you know, whatever soil is there, that's what we have to work with. We don't have a choice, you know, about saying, oh, I want a different experience. We don't have a choice here. But we have total choice, you know, to really make the most out of it in terms of practice. This is where we have a choice. And then, you know, if the internal changes, the external will change as well. And the climate crisis today is just like a reflection of the collective internal. It doesn't look very nice. But, you know, if we do our bit, we can contribute for that shift. And that's what I'd like to do, to the best of my abilities. And sometimes I also just go to sleep, but I just try to at least be aware of it, you know, that sometimes I just need to turn away from it and rest. That's okay too. So there's not much time left, but if anybody would like to comment or ask a question, please. Yes, please.
Thank you for your talk.
Thank you.
I've been thinking quite a lot about emotion and feeling myself these days, writing about it also.
Mm-hmm.
There are different words in English, and I wonder if you think it's important make any distinctions, or whether it's okay just to, well, sometimes you'll want to say emotion and feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also wonder if you can expand just a little more on prajna as feeling, as the main way to interconnect or to realize our interconnection with other beings and things.
Mm-hmm.
Just open it up a little.
Yes.
Say a little more about that.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, generally how I understand it, emotion, feeling is a part of emotion. So, you know, for example, a feeling arises and then, you know, it's we maybe not aware enough, you know, not mindful enough, so we start thinking about it. And then it becomes an emotion, you know, it starts with a feeling and then, you know, we put the thinking into it and then, you know, it becomes a whole mix. Or sometimes it can be just, you know, thinking something and then a feeling arises. So feeling is more like, you know, there's neutral feeling, pleasant feeling and unpleasant feeling. Neutral feeling we are mostly not aware of, but we are very aware of unpleasant feeling and pleasant feeling. So, you know, emotion is much more than just feeling. So I think, you know, for example, anger, jealousy, and you know, infatuation, all of that, that's emotions. And feeling is just a part of it. So the emotions, you know, which are built up around a pleasant feeling, we want more of those, isn't it? But what they all have a they have a quite deluding quality, because if we experience a certain situation or relationship through that veil of the emotions, then we don't really experience what's there, but it can be very colored, isn't it? It's very selective. We pick up certain clues, but we don't see others, and then we just go down that road, so to say, and maybe complicate our lives. And in terms of what I was saying about prajna or panya in the Pali language, yes, that was for me a very surprising to hear, that panya or prajna, it's not a body of knowledge, but it's the capacity, to be with the suchness, to be with the way things are. And any moment, we can be fully with experience as it is without kind of putting something on top of it. We are collecting information about the way things truly are, And then that's what we do in the formal meditation first, but then ideally we bring that in our daily lives. And then, if a certain amount of information is collected, at one point it shifts into an insight, and then suddenly you suddenly see into the depths of something, or you see the connections of something, and then you have an insight. And if that's a really deep insight, it can be, I don't know, you call that Satori or something in the Zen jargon, then it becomes something which is a permanent change, of the consciousness of that being. That there might be certain, we call it in the Pali language, we have this what's called fetters, which bind us to the wheel of becoming, of being, becoming in ignorance again and again. And then if there are certain insights which are very deep, then some of those fetters are cut off permanently, And then these kind of delusions, they won't be produced any longer. And then there's more capacity, to be with the way things are, if some of those delusions fall away permanently. And I don't know if you have observed it in your own life, but what is the most difficult element to be with is a very strong feelings, And in the what's called the dependent origination, it's a feeling where that wheel of becoming can be stopped, When feeling becomes grasping, attaching and grasping, this is where, if we wake up to it, this is when we can step out. But then if we don't let go, then we become it, and then we be born, and then we old age, sickness and death, and we're already down the drain. So it's at the feeling, where we can step out, feeling and attaching. If we can wake up to that, at the moment when the feeling comes, but this is a very fast process, when the feeling comes in, when the attaching or the pushing, when that, is the reaction, the knee-jerk reaction, so to say, if we notice it with mindfulness, there we can step out, But if we don't step out there, then we're already becoming it. We're already the angry one who has been saying those things, But if we notice, the contraction in the body, the heat coming up, the thoughts, if we notice it in that moment, we can still step out, I think it's now 11 o'clock. That's when you usually stop, isn't it? Thank you.